Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This week, that film is 2011's, produced by George Martin, a made-for-TV documentary from the same BBC Arena series that gave us the Brian Epstein story, covered in a previous episode. This documentary explores the career and life of famed Beatles producer George Martin, highlighting many of the artists he has worked with via a series of personal chats and talking head interviews. And I think we should probably address a key challenge with the film up front, which is that it's very difficult, I think, to do justice to such a long and storied career in just 90 minutes. And it's impossible to strike a balance, I think, between covering all aspects of his life while still also offering a focus on what he's best known for, which is obviously working with the Beatles, and then individually with just Paul. And I want to get your thoughts on that, because I think sometimes the film strikes that balance really well, and yet there is no denying that this is very much a film that chooses to include input from since-disgraced TV star and paedophile Rolf Harris.
Yes.
And yet still apparently doesn't want to mention Give My Regards to Broad Street.
I mean, which is the greater crime? what a fantastic curveball question to start off with. I think... The documentary is perhaps slightly unbalanced, but also this is one of those documentaries where really its focus is, here is this guy who is like now like a really nice old man, and he did all these remarkable things. And here are lots of people saying really nice things about what this really nice man did. And that is great. There's nothing wrong with that. So perhaps it is in danger of being a little bit unbalanced. And one of the things about these documentaries is that for all these documentaries that are, let's say, sort of Beatle adjacent, which we're trying to address every now and again, something that's not completely in and of itself Beatles, but features Beatles in one way or another. The Brian Epstein Arena documentary that you mentioned being another good example, is that obviously the subjects of those documentaries, they have done other things in their lives other than Beatles things.
Yeah.
But a lot of the time when you're watching them as a Beatles fan, it's really the Beatles stuff you want them to get to, you know? So it can maybe lead to you thinking this is a little bit unbalanced. But maybe that's just because of your expectations going in and what you want out of it. I do think it's true that once it gets through the Beatles bit of it, I remember like looking at the timer on the DVD and to see how long was left. And like once the Beatles have split up, there's about 15 minutes left or something like that. So like his whole 70s and 80s career and everything else is kind of
which is really interesting, isn't it? Because I think that, so first of all, I think there is a film in, a documentary in just George Martin and the Beatles, right? Clearly, that would be a really interesting thing to explore in a film. What this film does is obviously explore up front a little bit about George Martin's career, how he got into music and composition and studied composition, how he got his first job at EMI, and all of the work that he was doing as a producer up until the point he met the Beatles.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting, and we'll dig into that because there's loads of stuff that comes out in that period of the film where I'm like, oh, I know a lot of this stuff, and I had no idea that George Martin had a hand in that.
Yeah,
and of course, that's an interesting part of the story to tell, which is, you know, what led George Martin to the point where he ended up producing the Beatles, the greatest band of all time, if you like, right? Like, what path was he on that led him to that point?
Yeah.
Equally, what would be interesting is where did that then take him after the Beatles split up?
Yeah.
And the film has no interest in exploring that. It's very much that they skimmed through like five different bands and artists in the space of 30 seconds.
Yeah.
As a sort of a token thing of, this is what he did next.
Yeah.
But in my mind, I'm thinking he has just been the producer of and the recognized producer of the greatest band of all time, if you like. Surely that should have been a springboard for bigger and better things, and you know, what else did that lead to for him? So, but it feels like the documentary kind of ends when he stopped working with the Beatles a little bit.
Well, kind of. So, I mean, certainly it talks about him producing America, and it talks about him producing Jimmy Webb and Jeff Beck and sort of other artists as that went on, Live and Let Die a little bit. But yeah, it's not terribly interested in those sort of post-Beatles things. I suppose this is one of the things about the Beatles as a sort of cultural entity, is they seem to override other things, you know. So like, you know, when you talk to people who aren't Beatles fans, and they will sort of often express annoyance with like how ubiquitous the Beatles are, you know, and I appreciate that completely, you know. I get that it's a bit dull to have someone like banging on about this is the greatest band of all time, and there are no counter arguments to that, you know. It's
a very interesting point to make on this podcast, by the way.
Very interesting. let's explore that more, you know. but I think what people get annoyed about is that sort of cultural ubiquity in a way, and I suppose that's kind of what happens in documentaries like this, like because this guy. Like the most famous thing he did was be the main producer for the greatest band of all time, but this documentary is not per se only about that part of his work. However, naturally, maybe just in the edit, that's how it ends up being.
Yeah,
there's more Beatles stuff, and then the rest of it is kind of, you know, dealt with. You're given fairly short shrift afterwards, I suppose.
But I think I was left thinking. You know, there is a caption that comes up when he talks about opening his studio, Air Studios in Montserrat.
Yeah.
And there's a caption that comes up saying that, you know, from this point, George Martin worked with the likes of, and they mention the Police, Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, I think, at one point.
Elton John, certainly.
Oh, Elton John,
I don't
certainly.
Think Michael Jackson.
Did I make that up? I might have made that up. But maybe. Then there were a bunch of names there which don't get mentioned again. And I was I was left wondering, well, what work did he do with those big names?
Yeah.
And then what the film then does is to help illustrate that point, they play Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic by the Police. And that is the one instance I can think of in the film where it comes up, Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic by the Police. And it says produced by someone else.
Yes, I noticed that.
Yeah. So, like, well, why didn't you play the bit that George Martin actually did?
Well, I think probably the reason they did that is because he didn't produce it, but it was just done at his studio. I think that's probably the distinction they were trying to make. Because I noticed that credit come up. And I think it may have been because the way they were talking about it might have given the impression that he did produce it.
Yes.
But they wanted to make clear that actually it was someone else's work.
Okay, that makes sense. So it was at his studio, but it was a different producer working on that record.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I think, certainly in Elton John's autobiography, he talks about recording at Montserrat in the 80s. I think it was in the 80s, and I forget which album it is, but there's one or two of those big hits in the 80s, maybe I'm Still Standing or one from that era, I forget, that were done out in Montserrat. Right. But I don't think it was George Martin who produced them. I think actually his role in Montserrat mainly just to be the guy who owned the studio. I don't know specifically how much production he did out there. But certainly like he and Paul worked on stuff in Montserrat, I think, for the Tug of War album. It sort of mentions Stevie Wonder, so like Stevie Wonder appeared on that album as well. I think maybe that's where that came from.
And this is the point where I say that if I'm left asking these questions, then the film may have not done a very good job of clarifying those points, which in essence is a way of me saying that the film is at fault and not me for misunderstanding how that information was presented to me.
Yeah, it's definitely the film's fault, not yours.
although I do like the idea that the film was saying, oh, George Martin worked with Stevie Wonder and also Paul McCartney, but actually it might have been just the same song.
It may have been. I'm not completely sure, to be honest, but yeah, it's possible that that is the case, yeah.
So in terms of getting that balance right, do you think the film does a good job of representing his contribution to all of those pieces of work as well as the Beatles?
Yes, I think what it does a very good job of is talking about the comedy production work that he initially did at Parlophone. So before the Beatles sort of came into his orbit, he was mainly a sort of audio comedy producer working with the Goons, Peter Sellers, Spike Milligan, Harry Secombe, people like that. He's also, you know, it reminded me that when I was a kid, one of the cassettes we had in the car was At the Drop of a Hat, the review by Flanders and Swan from sometime in the 50s. That was something that I just knew off by heart. And I found it on vinyl in a secondhand shop a few years ago and bought it and took it home and played it and found that I still knew it off by heart. And I turned it over and it said produced by George Martin, which I'd had no idea
about. But you still knew it off by heart even from the 50s?
Exactly. I'm older than I look. So what it does a really good job of is emphasizing his contributions to that, you know.
Yeah,
so he makes the point in the documentary when he's talking about it that recording comedy is a hard job. Like it's laborious. Like you have to you have to come up with a script and you have to make sure the script works and you have to edit the script and then you have to like produce the people actually recording the thing. Mm-hmm. And he said that not that recording pop music is easy, but I think I get the impression that he was very much ready to find the Beatles as like creative collaborators. I think he was really ready to dive into that in a way where he could sort of be creative in a way that was a bit less sort of painstaking, if you like. And certainly there were definitely things he produced for the Beatles that were painstaking, you know, Strawberry Fields and Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite being like sort of obvious examples of where he really, really had to, it was a bit of a slog to sort of get the result at the end of the day. But I think he, in general, really, really enjoyed the opportunity to get in a studio with these boys and sort of give his sort of creative input without the sort of slog of like having a pre-prepared script and things like that and having to work from that, you know.
And I guess that's, you know, without wanting to sound like I don't want to sound like I'm doing it, him a disservice here, but I think one of the things that I felt was lacking in the documentary was exactly what contributions he was making at that point in his career. So when he talks about it, it's a difficult job to produce comedy shows where you have to get the right scripts in place and stuff. I don't know whether the film presents his role in that as doing anything other than just capturing that work on record. like I'm not left with an understanding of what contribution he has made to finalizing that script, to refining the comedy elements of that film and making it as good as it can be before it then gets recorded. I'm kind of, I feel like I wonder whether or not the film gives a bit of a simplistic view of the role of a producer. Because it kind of just gives me the impression that he just needs to make sure everything was in place so that he could flick the record switch.
Yeah.
Which obviously is a, you know, huge downgrade from all the work that he obviously would have done in that. I'm just not really left with an understanding of what that work was.
Yeah, true. I wonder whether it is like the documentary has to take a certain approach and it's sort of broad brush or very specific. So, you know, you think about things like sort of VH1 classic albums or something where it's always like, here is specifically how we recorded this thing. I am sitting at this mixing desk 50 years after we recorded this album, and I am like fading this thing up to show you exactly what we did at this point and stuff like that. Yeah. It's very technical, and that is what the audience wants from that.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a BBC Arena documentary. It's made for a sort of highbrow audience, if you like. You know, this is sort of the sort of audience who is watching arts programs on BBC Two, or it might have been BBC Four by the time this came. When did this come out? 2012?
Yeah, 2012. It was broadcast, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is exactly the kind of thing that's on BBC Four now. I couldn't tell you if BBC Four existed in 2012, but you know, it's exactly that kind of thing. So, like, you could make the case that actually the audience would have appreciated a bit more of that detail. And I agree with you. I know what you mean. It could have done with a bit more. It's one of those ones actually where I kind of thought, oh, you could have stuck another 15 minutes on this.
Yes, I agree.
Just for like, in terms of length, it could have borne it for sure, because it's quite pleasant and quite sort of amiable. Like, you know, you weren't not even getting close to outstaying its welcome. And actually, yes, a bit more of that detail, not really, really sort of geeky specific music or studio detail, you know.
Yeah.
But just a bit more about that role and what it involves is maybe what it was lacking a little bit.
I think that's the difference between when we talk about feature films and this, where filmmakers for feature films will probably have a little bit more flexibility with their runtime, whereas this is, as a BBC documentary series, is clearly made to order to a certain degree to fit with a certain format and time frame. The bits that I'm interested in, and by no means should it mean that this is the most important bits, but the bits that I'm interested in...
Well, you're a licensed fee payer, so you know, they should do exactly what you want, right?
But the bits I am interested in are how George would make tangible contributions to the work that he is producing in a way that I can then be like, oh, like that was George's input.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to from a technical point of view, like I like the idea of, I like understanding the creative input that he has had. And that extends to his role with the Beatles, because I think that his role as Beatles producer, obviously there's a whole load of work that goes into that role that I probably don't have the skill set to understand, to wrap my head around exactly what that means and why that's important.
Yeah.
But the bits that I can cling to are things like, this bit in this song was George. Mm. Like, he played the solo in My Life. Or, you know, this, the way this, there's an example that the film gives where he was the one to suggest to Paul that Can't Buy Me Love should start with a refrain from the chorus before they go into the verse, which I'd actually never heard before. I didn't realise that. I could have done with a load more of that, because I think there are loads of examples that I've heard previously about how George has really put a stamp on a lot of these songs that we now consider to be iconic. And I feel like showcasing his role in those a bit more would have been quite instrumental in a documentary like this that is celebrating his work in his life.
Yeah.
But actually, I found a lot of that missing.
Yeah. And actually, for someone like George, who like certainly when it came to his contributions to Beatles records, like, he was sort of fairly modest about it, but the ones that he would talk about quite a lot, which sort of notably absent from this film, interestingly, The main one being Strawberry Fields Forever, where it effectively what he ended up was two or three different parts of the same song, which were in different keys. And John Lennon basically said to him, well, you figure it out. And he did by speeding different bits up and, you know, and getting them into the same pitch and the same rhythm, which is amazing given the technology available to him. So that story is like fairly well known, fairly well worn, you might argue. And like, I'm not saying I want the sort of old anecdotes to be repeated, but you would expect.
You feel like they're a bit of standard and then everything else is a bonus. But actually, it was good, I think, for me to hear things that I hadn't heard before.
Yeah.
But it felt strange that some of those bigger contributions that have become standards because of their importance weren't brought into this.
Yeah. And you know, so we also watched some of the extras on the DVD. And so there's one where George is talking to Howard Goodall and he talks about being for the benefit of Mr. Kite, which is another one where it, like, famously John basically said to him, I want it to sound like a fairground. You figure it out.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll be back on Monday. You figure it out.
I want to smell the sawdust.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Because I read, years and years ago, I think it was George's book that had the clanging title, All You Need Is Ears. It was about the recording of Sgt. Pepper specifically. Maybe that is not the book I'm thinking of. There was a book that he wrote that was specifically about the recording of Sgt. Pepper. And that is absolutely full of all those anecdotes. And it goes into a lot of detail from my memory of the recording of being for the benefit of Mr. Kite and like how he got those specific sounds. That stuff is really interesting. And that's the kind of thing you kind of expect to be in here. Yeah, he and Howard Goodall mention it a bit in the extras, which are bits that were sort of effectively cut from the film. And yeah, you'd expect a bit more of that detail. There's a bit about Eleanor Rigby.
Yeah, I think there's a part of the reason why some of this detail is missing is because on the whole, I get the impression that George Martin is just incredibly modest about a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
He talks about the score to Yesterday and he says, oh, this is quite a naive score. And he has it, he says, this is... He talks about it being quite a naive score, and it's, you know, he said, but the idea of the song is its simplicity, and so he kind of downplays his role in having written that score and introduced strings to the Beatles music for the first time.
Yes,
it shouldn't go without saying that he's saying that whilst pointing at the score having framed it on his wall.
Yeah,
but and he talks in a similar way about the strings in Eleanor Rigby. And that interview with Howard Goodall, who goes into very, very geeky detail about music theory that is way over my head, talking about sort of false relationships to Tudor music and lots of sort of terminology that I hadn't heard before. And you kind of get the impression that George is kind of responding to that as a, like, yeah, that's just the way it was, or that was all Paul. First of all, he's very quick to not claim credit for a lot of that work and to make sure that everyone is aware that a lot of those songs and examples that Howard Goodall gives, that was all Paul who did that.
Yeah.
But he also, he doesn't go into a lot of detail about that relationship in the music, and he obviously understands it because he comes from a music and a background in composition. But he kind of just brushes it aside a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
And in some ways, it's really refreshing to watch a Beatles documentary. We don't get to see many Beatles documentaries where there is someone who isn't just trying to claim credit for everything, you know?
Because like, that quite the opposite. In yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I do wonder whether or not some of those contributions just sort of fall under the radar a little bit, just because he's the kind of person that doesn't want to boast or you know, brag about how much input he's had into these massively iconic songs.
Yes and no. Okay. Because there are certain hints in it that George Martin was not a man entirely free of ego. It's not a criticism of him. It's perfectly reasonable for someone of his achievements to have a bit of an ego about them. So one of which is where he sort of talks about his rivalry with Norrie Paramore, who was another A&R man at EMI who sort of had signed Cliff Richard and was the guy having hits. And he was always, like, it's well documented that he felt a bit of competition with Norrie Paramore, and you would in that kind of professional setting. And, you know, there's a funny story sort of later on that, like, Giles Martin, Giles is sort of interviewing George in the documentary, teases out of him where he's talking about, I think he sort of finally won some sort of award for being the producer who had the most number ones, and he's finally beaten Norrie Paramore. And, you know, he said to Giles, well, you know, I shouldn't think Norrie's going to beat me now, despite the fact that Norrie Paramore had been dead for a couple of years at that point. But the other thing that really struck me is, like, when he's talking about Let It Be, the Let It Be sessions that became the Let It Be album. Of course, this documentary comes out in 2012, so we're sort of 10 years or so before the release of the Get Back documentary, which obviously just sort of recontextualized that period and the sessions for that album. So George is saying in this documentary that he was put out when Phil Spector was sort of given the tapes to produce, and then the credit on it said produced by Phil Spector. And he said, well, can I have overproduced by by Phil Spector? Yes, but, you know, original sessions produced by George Martin. Now that we have seen Get Back, if you take what the footage we see in Get Back as sort of decent enough evidence, I know it doesn't cover the entire period, I think it's probably more reasonable to say that Glyn Johns mainly produced those sessions.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
George actually, like, one of the things about Get Back was that George Martin was involved more than I thought he'd been. Like, yeah. he was there more than I thought. And he was certainly overseeing things, and he was sort of coming in and giving Glyn Johns pointers and things like that. But I don't think he was producing those sessions. Now, so I'm not saying that, like, George in this documentary is sort of making it up. And it may be, like, you know, as we see the big thing about the Get Back documentary as opposed to what we thought of Let It Be before that, is that everyone involved remembers it in a very different way to how it actually was, or at least to how Get Back indicated that it was. So, you know, I think it's probably fair to say that George has sort of misremembered, or at least he sort of put himself at the center of that a bit more than was actually the case. So certainly, like, he was a man who had, it seemed to have the sort of the instinct to downplay his own achievements in that sort of quite British way. Sort of men of his generation were not very comfortable sort of trumpeting their own achievements. But I think there were also bits where he maybe sort of overplayed his involvement in things.
You're right. It puzzled me a little bit when George Martin was talking about that. And I had heard that overproduced by Phil Spector gag before.
Yeah.
But it did give me pause to think, I don't really remember him doing enough to claim that credit in the first point. So, interesting that he would make that suggestion.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Session. I don't know how you felt about this, but I was a little bit taken aback in the first, like, 5-10 minutes of the film, because it seemed to jump around a bit at the start, and I felt that kind of little bit all the way through the film. So right at the start, when you're watching a film called Produced by George Martin, you know, these films tend to start with a bit of an overview of his achievements throughout his career, and then it'll take you right back to the start of how he set out upon that journey into his profession.
Yeah.
This film starts with him driving down the road with his wife and them telling the story of how they met, which was that Judy was a secretary at EMI when George got his job there.
Yeah.
So they talk a little bit about that. Then they go back to the start of George's life and how he got into his career as a producer. Mm. And it seemed like a strange starting off point for me. It's almost like, you know, you start off that way if one of the key themes of your film is going to be how George and Judy and their love has endured the, you know, 50 odd years since they first met. But it doesn't really do that. It was just a sort of an interesting anecdote that starts the film, and then it goes on to George's life. And there are a few things throughout the film where I feel like, oh, you kind of jumped into this other sort of area. You know, like half of you talking about George working with the Beatles, it suddenly talks about his hearing issues.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to him at like a sort of a university seminar thing talking about how he discovered he had hearing difficulties.
Yeah.
Which is something that happened at a later date, and then it comes back again to the Beatles. And it just seems a little bit incoherent in terms of, you know, not incoherent as in I couldn't follow it, but it wasn't very cohesive in terms of a narrative and at what point things happened and when.
Yeah, it skips around a lot, certainly. It's not really picking a narrative and sticking to it. It's kind of jumping around all over the place, really.
Yeah, and there's another bit about that which I don't know if you felt this way, and I can't really quite put my finger on why it seemed strange to me, but the film starts with Giles Martin sort of asking questions to his dad on their sofa.
Yeah.
And then after about 15 minutes or so, the next question is being asked by Michael Palin in some sort of venue.
Yeah.
And then later on it's Ringo talking to George, and then later on it's Paul talking to George, and I was trying to, it seemed to jump between interviews, and I don't know if it's because normally there's someone who leads on this kind of documentary or not, and there's like a person who is the driving interviewer.
Even if they're unseen a lot.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But it just seemed a little bit like lots of chats have taken place and they've edited together into one sort of narrative.
Yeah.
And also, like, as part of that was the thing about having like one interviewer is normally you know that interviewer would go to George Martin's house and question him, and then maybe he would then take him or be present or not when George Martin is visiting things like his childhood home, as he does here in Drayton Park and stuff. But because he seemed to have lots of chats with lots of different people, I couldn't help get the impression that they just made George Martin go around lots of people's houses to be the subject of his own documentary. You know what I mean? He had to get on the bus a lot. To, like, oh, you're with Ringo now. Like, Ringo can't make it here, so do you mind just going back over to him again? Like,
right,
making,
right.
Like, a 45-minute journey.
Right, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I just couldn't help but think that George Martin had to be put out by in some way in order to make this work.
Yeah, well, I mean, he'd have had free bus travel by that point, wouldn't
so
you?
Well,
so,
yeah.
You know, he was probably fine. And also just a very nice, you know, amiable sort
of
fellow.
I'm sure he would have been fine. You do get the impression that he
wouldn't want to put anyone out.
No,
so,
exactly,
yeah,
exactly. No, exactly that. But, you know, do you know what I mean? Like, it felt like there was a lot of... let's capture what we can and then we'll make it work in the edit. And then because of that in the edit, what we get is a little bit of, oh, now George is here talking to this person instead, when actually it follows on from the point he was making in the previous section.
Yeah, so I think the bits where he is talking to Paul and he is talking to Ringo, which is separate, they feel a bit less like interviews and more like conversations. The Michael Palin bit, they are talking specifically about his work with the Goons and, you know, the sort of audio comedy he recorded. So obviously that kind of makes sense in context. Actually, yeah, it's interesting that you sort of equate those things with the Giles Martin bit, because I hadn't really thought of it in that sense. But you're absolutely right. There is no reason for me to have thought of those things differently. I kind of felt more of the bit where Giles is talking to him on the sofa, as that was sort of more the sort of main interview that drove the whole thing. But actually thinking about it, in terms of its screen time, that's in documentaries of this nature, if you've got like this guy's son, is effectively interviewing his father, especially given that Giles, you know, is qualified to talk about, you know, music production. You would have thought that usually that would be a sort of more of a framing device for the whole documentary.
In a similar way to Mary McCartney interviewing Paul for Wingspan.
Yeah. But just sort of, you know, less inappropriate in a way. Like a framing device for the whole thing, you know, and you might even put Giles a bit more sort of front and center as like the main narrator and things, you know, and things like that. But one way where it does seem to, it would be sort of trying to make the narrative a bit more cohesive is like the use of audio comedy that George produced seems to come back as a sort of a theme that they're sort of using over lots of clips. So again, you know, this is one of those documentaries where it sort of needs sound to sort of play over clips. Often with documentaries, it's the other way around. Like they've got a lot of audio and they need like pictures to put over it. But they seem to be sort of coming back to this as a theme, which is nice because, you know, it is obviously, it's not like too Beatle heavy, you know, so it'd be easier just to come back to sort of Beatles songs because they do have the rights for Beatles songs on this. They are using them over it. But actually they're sort of stressing his work as a comedy producer. So it keeps on coming back to sort of Peter Sellers stuff that he's done in particular. And it really reminded me actually that like years and years, this is a bit of a tangent and I apologize, but like years and years ago, there was a pub I used to go to in London, and in the gents toilets, they would play BBC audio comedy, like The Goon Show and things like that. So, you know, up until the 80s and you had, and I was trying the other night with a friend of mine to remember the name of this pub and I can't. So if you're listening to this, if you're listening to this and you know there's a pub somewhere in sort of centralish London where the toilets were in the basement, I remember.
Centralish, you say? The toilets in the basement? Exactly. Right, okay. I mean, we've got to be able to narrow this down.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'm sure, like, you know, using the same techniques as the True Crime podcast, you know, surely we can narrow this down. But yeah, if anyone knows the name of the pub I'm thinking of that used to play, or maybe still does play, audio comedy in the gents' toilets, please tweet us. It's been driving me mad.
I mean, tweet him. I'm fine. I'm okay with not knowing.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Don't tweet Matt. I can't stress that enough.
one of the things I actually really liked about that use of that those comedy recordings, though, was it made me realise what a good sketch it is to just have someone dryly recite lyrics. Because you've got Peter Sellers doing that twice in this film.
Yes.
One with Can't Buy Me Love, and I think the other one was Hard Day's Night, when he's dressed almost in like Shakespearean clothing, sitting on a throne and stuff. And just being able to sort of deliver these sort of smirky, grinning lines, a bit sultry.
Yeah.
It's just brilliant. It's just that's just a great comedy conceit.
Yeah, and also sort of taking the sting out of them in a way that was quite subversive. So, you know, like, I suppose, you know, in context at that time, the Beatles would have been seen as like quite shocking. Saying yeah was quite shocking and quite quite an uncouth Americanism, and sort of taking that and putting it, reframing it in the context of a sort of dry Shakespearean actor reciting it is really funny and a very good comic conceit.
I love, and the things you look for as a Beatles fan are those moments where you have Ringo and Paul come in and talk to George. Yeah. But I think it's in my nature to pick up on stuff that I'm like, really, is that okay to you to say? Because there were lovely moments in both of those sets of interviews. For example, I'll give you a for example with Ringo. George talks about how during the war, the house five doors down from him had obviously had a bomb dropped in it, or had disappeared, and the house next to it, half of it was missing. And you could just see a bath hanging out, still attached by its pipes. Mm. Ringo's reaction to that was, "Oh, you had a bath, did you?" I didn't have a bath. You must have been rich. Yeah, I was like, how does Ringo make himself out to be the victim when George is telling a story about being like in a war-torn street? But it did seem to make it a bit of a competition as to who was in the worst
situation. But actually, I mean, the reveal, the sort of two like quite revealing things about that exchange were that the Beatles always kind of saw George as a bit of an authority figure. He was older. He was sort of maybe 10, 15 years older, something like that. And he was posh as far as they were concerned. Actually, one of the interesting things about this film is they talk about how like his upbringing was certainly more humble. He was sort of more of a cockney, as like Giles Martin puts it, and then like deliberately sort of trained himself at the age of 16 to speak in more of a sort of proper
BBC
manner.
Voice.
Yeah, the sort of received pronunciation kind of thing, which is very interesting. And so I think there was always that sort of like good-natured class, not warfare, but, you know, just, you know, between the Beatles and George Martin, you know, is part of the reason why they worked so well together, sort of opposites they were. The other thing is that Ringo makes the comments like, "Oh, we never had a bath." And George says, "Really, you must have been filthy." And
that is nice, actually.
But they have a nice little joke about it. And actually, the fact that he had a sense of humour was something that they found appealing, and particularly when they knew that he'd worked on like the Goons records, which, you know, they'd grown up listening to on the radio. And also another anecdote that you'd expect that doesn't get told is the George Harrison saying, "Well, I don't like your tie for a start," which is an anecdote so well worn it now has its own Twitter account. which is excellent, by the way. Everyone should follow it. And that it gets a bit of an airing in the extras of the documentary, but it's not in the main thing. But I mean, that is quite key in terms of their relationship. It's sort of tempting to say in that it sort of it relaxed everyone. Made them realise they could cheek him a bit and that the sort of class divide that they perceived between the two of them, between the Beatles and George, was something that could be bridged with humour.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, that makes sense. I actually quite liked as well, there were lots of nice moments with his interviews with Paul.
Yeah.
They're not interviews, are they? They're chats, really. Reminiscences are being captured on camera.
Yeah.
But There are a few nice moments in that. One, which is that Paul mentions a record that he had, and he said, "Oh, I used to carry that around with me, and it was one that was produced by George." And George seemed surprised by that. Mm. Like, all the time they spent together, it doesn't seem like he was aware of that happening. And he was very much, "Oh, did you?" Like, he was surprised by that.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a nice sort of moment to bring into that. But there are lots of sort of interesting moments, I think, in that section of the film, such as when they play the both of them a snippet of the Beatles talking in the microphone and trying to get George Martin to contribute, and George is completely baffled and he's like, "I don't know what this is. Like, when did that happen?" Mm. And Paul does that thing where he's like, "Oh, I think you'll find that's the Beatles fan club Christmas record."
Yeah.
And George, like, you can visibly see him be like, "Oh, yeah, of course, that was a thing as well." Like, he genuinely hadn't remembered that was a thing. And it was really interesting that he was, and maybe you wouldn't unless you were like a hardcore Beatles fan. Most people aren't aware of those fan club recordings,
true,
right?
True.
But it was just nice to have that sort of, to see them too. Like, be reminded of this thing that they literally would have not prepared for at all and just recorded off the cuff spontaneously and not thought about much since.
Yeah, I think with those Christmas fan club recordings, I think sort of every October or November or so, they would literally just find half an hour of studio time or whatever it was and just busk it, you know, and that was it. And so, you can imagine that George might have forgotten that, because as far as he was concerned, it was just something that he just turned the tapes on and let them go ahead and do.
Yeah, of course. And it's interesting as well that then you start to get an impression of at what point in that part of the Beatles' career George had involvement in, and actually how separate that was to everything else the Beatles had on at the time.
Mm.
Because that is for the fan club thing, which George probably, you know, wouldn't have been as invested in, clearly, right?
Yeah.
And he mentions you know, so Paul makes the point about how they had to do two songs in 3 hours. So they, you know, when they were recording albums and stuff, which I've heard a lot, you know, they obviously they've had to record in the short space of time, which meant they had to come prepared and and stuff. What I hadn't heard before was George's response to that, an explanation, which was that he was only given like an afternoon at a time to record them. You know, this idea of him saying, I need time at the studio with the lads, and Brian saying, well, I can give you next Friday afternoon, you know, and of course that makes sense, but I never heard that side of that story before.
Yeah, it's actually interesting to hear it from that point of view, isn't it? And you sort of get the impression that actually there was almost a tension between those two things, i.e. The Beatles' commitments as stars and their commitments as musicians, i.e. Producing the output that would make them stars, whereby they were just the idea, I think, broadly speaking, EMI wanted from them 2 albums a year and however many singles a year, 3 or 4 singles a year, which it tended for the most part to be songs that were not on the albums. So it's a lot to like put out, but this is also, you know, you think around sort of 64, 65, this is also at the same time as they are constantly touring and doing interviews and maybe radio sessions and things like that, and making a feature film each year as well.
Yeah.
It's an enormous amount of work. And I suppose it's interesting that sort of George was sort of the stuff that, I mean, the reason we're sitting here now is, you know, because of it's because of the music, you know, it's why it's the starting point for why everyone loves the Beatles. And it's interesting that sort of George had to kind of like fight for a bit of extra time,
yeah,
to sort of, you know, to get more, to get a bit more time to sort of make the music better, you know. And, you know, I mean, how good would it have been if he'd got more time? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Would it have been even better?
An extra, you know, half an hour now. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
What's also nice about chat with Paul is, I mean, it's just filled with great stuff, actually. Like, this is what's so nice about a documentary like this, where you have, we get together, Paul and George, in a space, and just in a very short space of time, there's lots of fun things that come out of that chat.
Mm.
I like them reminiscing over a photo that had been taken from 1964, where Brian Epstein has a chamber pot on his head.
Yeah.
I think George Martin very sort of politely says that it was a bit naughty, wasn't it? And I think they give the gist that the food apparently was all phallically shaped.
Yeah.
And first of all, I mean, I was just amazed that they could remember it at all, like, yeah, from that photo, yeah, which is just brilliant.
But there is a specific reason why they can remember it, because I think they say it's in Paris.
Yes, right, yes.
And in Paris in early 1964 is, I think, where the news first came through that they were number one in America.
Oh, right, okay.
And I think that's and so from that point, and that's when they then went on to go and do, you know, what they always say is like, well, we always said we're not going to America until we're number one.
Yes.
Whether that's entirely true or not, we're not completely sure. But that seems to have been the spur for them to like go on. You know, so like those nights were ones that they would remember. Like, they have talked about finding that out in Paris and like celebrating quite wildly. So it may be that the reason they remember that, over and above the fact that like one of them like had a chamber pot on his head, which is quite memorable,
and they're eating penis-shaped food. But yes,
yeah, I suppose these things do make for a memorable night.
I mean, added up, it probably makes for a memorable night, doesn't it? Yeah, you're right.
For me, just having a chamber pot in my head makes for a memorable night.
But I remember every time you've done that.
Yeah. But you've forgotten all the times I was number one in America.
There's also a lovely moment in that as well. Not to keep going on about the same section, but where George presents Paul with a photo and says, you know, it's a photo of George and his wife Judy, and saying, do you remember where that was taken? And Paul takes one look at it, and it's just a really simple, I think it's there on the back of a pickup truck or something, it's a really simple black and white photo.
Yeah.
And Paul immediately says, oh, did Linda take this? And George says, yes, she did. And he said, oh yeah, I thought it looked like her work.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, like, that's really sweet.
Yes.
That he could see a photo of just two people, like, it just looked like any photo that anybody would take of two people, but Paul being so close to Linda and her work was able to identify something in it that made him recognize that photographer. And I thought, what a nice thing to sort of to think about,
yeah,
you know, that there are the hallmarks
within Linda's work as a photographer that even in a simple photo like that, Paul was instantly able to pick up on it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it was really nice that, I thought, you know, it just sort of emphasized, I mean, you know, it's no secret how close Paul and Linda were and how much in love they were. But yes, being able to recognize her work, just a photograph she took that, like, to my eyes didn't look particularly remarkable, but he could see, oh yeah, yeah, that looks like her style. It's like, you know, yeah, yeah. It was nice to see that, you know. I think there's something in, you can see in the interactions that George has with Paul and Ringo in these exchanges where, because they're talking about, Ringo makes a joke about sort of like being on drugs or something like that, you know, and it's one of those times that sort of, that reminds you of the sort of straightness and in particular the Britishness that George Martin is sort of so emblematic of. And actually, there's a lot in this film, by the way, in terms of the way his life is framed at the time. I mean, he lives in just the most English country village you could possibly imagine, you know, and he and Judy do this thing where they sort of open up their garden for charity once a year. And, you know, they seem to do like a little raffle or a fete or something like that, yeah. You know, and it's just like really, really wonderfully British, the whole thing. And it reminds you that Howard Goodall actually makes the point in one of the outtakes when he's making those specific points about the Beatles music, that he's always found it particularly British. And it's interesting that he mentions that, because there is something very, very British about the Beatles, as George points out in it. You know, he says to Howard Goodall, well, they were British, you know.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
which by the way is very dryly funny.
Yes,
another example of the sense of humor that would have appealed to them, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
But as I mentioned earlier about the sort of class difference between them, there's a Britishness to George Martin that I think would have appealed to them, is something that they could be cheeky about and subvert. But also, a lot of their music is about sort of subverting Britishness, you know. So, I mean, if you think about things like When I'm 64, which is obviously sort of a musical pastiche until you get into the middle eight, where it kind of drops down into that minor chord and all gets a bit sort of eerie and almost disturbing. Exactly the same thing with Penny Lane, the sort of drop from major to minor that you get at the end of, you know, and the fireman rushes in, you know, and it drops from B major to B minor. And the whole thing immediately, it's painted this picture of sort of perfect idyllic suburban Englishness, but then that change to a minor chord just sort of makes you think, oh, everything here is not quite as it should be. What's going on here? I feel a little bit unsettled in some way. And I think that having George Martin around as that sort of seemingly just being a sort of totem of like sort of perfect Englishness just sort of gave them a counterpoint in a way. It's hard to describe exactly, but I think they just sort of gave them something to play off in a way. You know? But I mean, also, I mean, he himself was making lots of key contributions that were sort of really creative. And you know, he talks in this about sort of figuring out, you know, sort of backwards tapes and things, you know, on Rain, you know, that's sort of his idea. And he says, you know, after that, like, they wanted everything backwards.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And you know, what's really interesting, though, about him, that you definitely get the idea that he is this quintessentially English person.
Yeah.
It comes up again and again throughout the documentary. It does make me wonder whether or not one of the reasons why the documentary can feel a little bit unfocused in places is because there isn't this clear, like, sensationalized narrative to cling to. You know, like, in the same way that the Brian Epstein story, as a previous Arena Doc series episode, was able to sort of dig into this sort of sordid part of his past, or you know, outside of the Beatles, there's no inkling of that at all with George. Like, no. He is and he even says by the end of the film, he basically says, just, you know, just had a very nice life, you know, and that's all there was to it. Which I love. I think it's really, you know, the film builds out this impression of him as just someone who is just incredibly lovely and well-meaning, very, very incredibly talented, and that's all there was to it. And he was in love with his wife, and they had incredibly, you know, incredible long-term marriage that lasted all throughout his career. And he just did that and just led a very nice life. And on the one hand, I feel like that's amazing. On the other hand, I don't know how that happens with someone who looks as sexy as he did during most of those early stages of his career. And the film knows this as well. There is, when the film starts playing Live and Let Die,
yep.
and it is doing it deliberately over shots of George Martin smoking a cigarette,
yep.
looking every inch like Ian Fleming's James Bond.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, how, you know, just sex on a stick, yeah. and he... And then it cuts to him just being very old. At the end of it, being like, oh, I'm just a nice fella.
Yeah.
It's a stark contrast, but yeah, it just seems like an amazing life that's well lived. And actually, the documentary, I wonder if maybe it struggles a little bit to find something beneath the surface with him, because that's all there is.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe it's not particularly looking for anything beneath the surface. But I mean, you know, the makers of this documentary would have 100% known that George and Judy, when they got together, George was married and they had, and Judy was a secretary at EMI and they had an affair.
Scandal.
I know, exactly.
It's not mentioned at all in the documentary, is it?
I know. I'm only now lifting the lid on this exclusive story. But it's been covered up for all these years and now we can exclusively reveal. That is true. Now, I mean, look, you're absolutely right to say that they then went on to be married for the rest of their lives. But, you know, there was a bit of scandal about that. And I think there was a bit of scandal around EMI at that. I think it might have affected George's career a little bit. I think the higher-ups at EMI were not all that keen on you know, gentlemen having affairs, you know, or certainly gentlemen having affairs that people found out about, you know.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. I thought it was all the rage.
So they didn't get into that, but I don't think a film like that particularly needs to get into that, you know. I think documentaries these days they need sort of conflict and resolution in the same way that a sort of narrative film does. They need to have a bit more of a narrative in general. This is sort of fairly nuts and bolts presenting the events of his life, not in a particularly linear fashion, as we've pointed out, but it's more or less just taking you through the greatest hits of what the guy achieved.
Mm.
Perhaps like a sort of arena documentary doesn't need to do more than that, although, as we discussed, maybe for the audience it could have done with a little bit more detail. But it doesn't particularly... I suppose in terms of adversity that's been overcome, there's a bit of that with the Montserrat bits towards the end, where it was sort of the studio that he built was sort of destroyed by the hurricane, and then he they basically had to abandon it, and then he sort of raised money to build the cultural center in Montserrat, you know. So that's a nice sort of, like, you know, Phoenix from the Ashes kind of story. But I mean, that is dealt with entirely in about 6 minutes, you know. The whole thing. So I mean, the film is not looking for conflict and resolution, and maybe it doesn't really need to, you know.
You're right. However, we should probably address the fact that as much as it clearly deliberately skips over this sort of potential for scandal early on in his career, it does address head on what is potentially a bigger scandal, which is obviously George Martin's martini making technique.
Yeah.
Now, as you know, I am someone who is very passionate about making cocktails.
Yep.
What this film does at this point, when it starts talking about Live and Let Die, it very deliberately tries to make a connection between George Martin and James Bond for reasons.
Yeah.
And clearly the filmmakers have set up a camera in his kitchen and just said, make a martini, go on, because we're going to talk about Live and Let Die. So just make a martini, and then we can just edit that in at a point where he starts talking about James Bond and it makes sense.
Yeah.
And it does feel very contrived.
Mm-hmm.
And then George Martin proceeds to make the sorriest martini I've ever seen committed to camera. He's very right in saying that shaking a martini doesn't bruise the gin, which is a phrase that was adopted a long time ago that means nothing. He says what it does do, with a wry smile, is it makes it much colder.
Yeah.
You can just do the same thing if you're stirring for longer, so it's fine.
Right.
What shaking a martini does is dilute it more.
Yeah.
And also what you get, especially when you use the really bad straining technique that George uses for this martini, is you get lots of shards of ice in the drink, which means that when he pours out his martini, it's very cloudy.
Yeah.
And what you want is a nice, clean, crisp martini.
Yeah.
But the worst thing he does at all, completely with his martini, is he then cuts off a little bit of lemon peel.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why you do that is you cut off a bit of lemon peel and you squeeze the lemon oils out from that lemon peel over the drink to give it like a mist of citrus, okay, before you drop it in the drink.
Yeah.
His lemon is so ripe that he has cut off this scrawny bit of peel.
No.
There's no oil left in that at all. That is just like a rancid section of lemon and drops it in, all whilst talking about the how to make the perfect martini.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's one of the worst things I've seen in all of the films that we have covered for this podcast.
Right, yeah.
And we've watched Give My Regards to Broad Street.
Yeah, he's embarrassed himself, right. Would Phil Spector have made a better martini? Do you think?
He would have overproduced that martini.
Yeah, do you think?
I mean, but think of the layers.
They should have taken the martini off him, given it to Phil Spector. Like 3 months later, given Phil Spector the constituent parts of that martini and said, here, put this together.
I don't know about you, but I was, watching this documentary, and when they go through some of the songs that George had a hand in producing before he met the Beatles, I was surprised by how many of them I knew.
Mm.
Like, and this is from a period that is, I don't tend to listen to music from this period a lot, and some of these songs would have been covered, and I probably would have heard later versions of them. But the originals were there, and actually they're very famous songs, and they have their own part in sort of, I guess, in our sort of cultural identity, if you will.
And the nice thing is, it's like he's just sort of sitting in his chair in his house, and they've brought these speakers, which they seem to be taking around sort of all the interviewees when they want to play them audio clips. And they look like the kind of speakers that you used to plug into your old Windows 95 PC to get like slightly better sound. And the audio quality they're getting out of them can't be that good. But, he's sort of sitting there listening to these songs. And one that comes on is what is like immediately recognizable is the theme tune to The Archers. And it's called Barwick Green. And he's listening to it, and he sort of looks at the camera, or looks at the interviewer, and says, "The Archers."
Yeah.
As if you don't know. And it's like, because it's the most quintessentially British thing there is.
Yeah.
And I think that the Archers theme has been re-recorded a couple of times, and so the version that you now hear on Radio 4 is not the same one that George recorded. But there was a point at which that he produced and recorded like one of the most iconic pieces of music associated with Britishness in general, and he's just so casual about it, and I had no idea that was the case at all.
No, not at all. You know. But also, the film skips over it quite quickly, I think. Like the film, nowhere else in that section is The Archers mentioned.
No,
apart from the way he casually mentions it to the camera, like The Archers. And it's like, well, hang on a minute, this is like one of the most recognisable themes ever.
Right.
And you would have thought they'd spend a little bit more time on that.
Yeah. But that's, it's sort of, it suits a man who just seems to be kind of so self-effacing,
Yes.
It's quite a nice, and again, very British thing to make a documentary about a man who's made all these achievements, in which, like, a lot of his achievements are just kind of glossed over because he's not the kind of guy who talks about himself a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
And actually,
that's
like,
so true.
The whole thing could be a documentary that's like 15 minutes long.
Yeah, exactly.
Just where him and the Beatles were just like, oh, then I met the Beatles. And we made some records, which were lovely. I had a lovely time.
And Nelly the Elephant, like stuff like that. What a weird... I would never would have guessed in a million years that George Martin produced Nelly the Elephant.
Yeah, and so, Right Said Fred by Bernard Cribbins as well. These are songs, our generation, probably does know these a bit from them being like reused in adverts a bit in the 80s or something like that. But also, the sort of Right Said Fred song is something that my dad would sort of sing to himself a bit if he was like doing some wallpapering or something, would like make the joke of...
Do you think that's what it is? So in our generation, so we would have grown up in like the 80s and we would have heard cover versions of those in, say, adverts.
Yeah.
Is that the equivalent of when John Lewis has this like soulful version of Half the World Away in their Christmas ads. Like, it's just, it's the same pattern, isn't it?
Right, like, right. Yeah.
Like 20 or 30 years later, you're just going to have these songs come up on adverts again, and that's how they sell products.
Right, yeah. Is Noel Gallagher a Bernard Cribbins for the TikTok generation? You know?
Yes.
It's worth posing the question.
So I don't know how you feel. Well, I mean, I don't even know how you, whether or not you think it's worth comparing it to the Brian Epstein story, in terms of two BBC Arena documentary episodes that we've now covered about Beatles adjacent people. But I still sort of come back to this point on this one, that there's a clear difference in the story to be told between the two people, and I think that this film is an easier watch because it's more modern. But also there's sort of a less of a clear narrative to sort of cling everything to in this. So whereas the Brian Epstein story was probably told more dramatically and was possibly a little bit more compelling as a result, this is just a lovely old film about a lovely old guy, isn't it? Really?
Yeah. No, well, I mean, that Brian Epstein story documentary chose a narrative approach and went with it. And, you know, there are questions to be asked about the sort of morality of the narrative approach it took, and about the sort of participation of, like, some of the talking heads. But, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Like, it's not an accusation you could hang on this. It's celebratory is what it is, and quite rightly. And actually, a lot of the media that was depicting George Martin, you know, in the last sort of 20 years or so of his life, was very celebratory. If you think about, there's another film called In My Life about him. There's another, and there was, do you remember, it must have been commemorating some Beatles anniversary or other, where there was an album of different contributors re-recording Beatles songs that George Martin was producing.
Yes,
including,
I do,
like, Jim Carrey doing I Am the Walrus.
Yes, of course. Yeah, I remember seeing that footage a lot. Yeah,
and,
of course.
And things like that. That was all just very, very celebratory. Mm. So he does seem to be this figure who's just sort of universally loved. I mean, you never hear anyone say a bad word about him.
No.
And actually, it's sort of in that spirit that this film is made, and there's no reason for it to be made in any other spirit, really.
But yeah, exactly, and I think it's actually quite refreshing for us to be watching a documentary where there's no ounce of cynicism.
Yeah,
there's no reason for us to sort of question motives, or for anybody to be seen to be trying to steal attention or claim credit for anything that's not valid. Yeah, it all seems very just nice and above board, and hopefully perfectly in keeping with George as a character. So that would all make sense. But
apart from the martini,
which is just atrocious. But maybe some of our listeners may have seen this and think differently. If you are one of those listeners and you've seen this film, this documentary episode, we'd love you to get in touch with us. You can reach us at Beatles Films Pod on all of the usual social media platforms. You can also, if you have heard this episode and have enjoyed listening to it, you could leave us a review or a 5-star rating on your streaming platform of choice. Otherwise, we will see you again next week for another episode. Until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.